Welcome to Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary. Hello and welcome to Working the Lectionary, a podcast in which the world of work is examined through readings from the weekly lectionary. My name is Brendan Byrne, and I am one of the co-hosts, and as always, it's a pleasure to welcome my co-host, John Bottomley.
Thanks, Brendan. Good to be with you again.
It's always good to see you here, John. In this episode, we will be examining our reading for Pentecost 5, which comes from Genesis 22, 1-14. A reading from the book of Genesis, chapter 22, verses 1-14. After these things God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and there offer him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall show you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering, and set out and went to the place in the distance that God had shown him. On the third day Abraham looked up and saw the place far away. Then Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac said to his father Abraham, Father. And he said, Here I am, my son. He said, The fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham said, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. When they came to the place that God had shown him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to kill his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham! And he said, Here I am. He said, Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham looked up and saw a ram, caught in a thicket by its horns. Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, The Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. Now, this is a hugely controversial text in modernity, one which is often used by the opponents of religious belief as a proof text demonstrating religion's allegedly violent and oppressive nature. What kind of God, after all, would command a father sacrifice his son as a test of faith? And what kind of father would agree to such a demand, except perhaps one who had been hoodwinked and brainwashed by religious strictures? But this text has also been subject to a lot of artistic interpretation. One thinks, for example, of Caravaggio's painting, in which the full horror of the situation is depicted in the expression on Isaac's face as he's about to be sacrificed, or of Rembrandt's dramatic rendition, depicting the moment the divine messenger literally grabs Abraham's arm to stop him from cutting Isaac's exposed throat. And then there is that iconic poem, The Parable of the Old Man and the Young, by the World War I British poet Wilfred Owen, which depicts Abraham in fact refusing to halt the sacrifice, and in the process killing an entire generation in the horrors of trench warfare. These artistic interpretations seem to me to get closer to the heart of this narrative than the literalist reading of those who want to use this as a proof text to condemn religious belief. Because what this reading seems to me to speak of is, as it were, the pity of human life, of our powerlessness in the broader context of existence. In the person of Isaac, we are presented with the helplessness of those who are powerless in the face of human structures of command and authority, or even of just of circumstance. And this helplessness is given extra poignancy by the total trust Isaac displays in his father. This sense of powerlessness runs entirely contrary to the primary myth of modernity, the myth of the autonomous, self-realizing individual who, by dint of sheer hard work and willpower, can arrange a reality to suit their own preferences and purposes. And one of the principal mechanisms through which this myth says we can achieve this self-actualization is through work. And yet, as many of us discover to our cost, we find ourselves bent instead to the prerogatives and whims of those who hold authority over us and to the ultimate demands of the ethic of profit maximization. John, this is a pretty chilling, confronting text. Where does it offer hope in the context of the powerlessness so many people experience in work? And does it depict a divine structure of relationship that is at odds with human structures of power?
Gosh, Brendan. Glad you get to ask the questions. I'd hate to be dealing with someone who asks tough questions. Tough questions. You're right about that. I mean, I think your reflection on the artistic sort of resonances with the text are really helpful, because it is a chilling text, and the reality that people have seen in God's parent sort of, well, in God's instruction, you know, to sacrifice, for Abraham to sacrifice his son as a sort of a justification for domestic violence and child abuse and so on is that's real. That's what's going on. And you can see that's there. It's not, I don't think it helps just to sort of brush it away. If I could explore that a little bit more, I think that Abraham is getting a taste of his own medicine.
Yes. Yeah.
So while it's all right for Abraham to sort of give Hagar the flick and Ishmael, essentially condemn Ishmael to death. Now God sort of said, okay, well, you were happy to comply with what I wanted then, but it didn't really affect you. But now I want you to be the hand of death, and sets this in train. And what does Abraham do? But complies. So I think that the Bible is full of irony in a way. I mean, you know, so if you only read one or other of these, you might get a wrong impression about where, you know, that God sort of justifies violence and so on. But it does seem to me that if you hold the two in tension, then Abraham's getting his comeuppance at the moment, if you like. You know, that you thought that was God who said this. Now this is God who says that. And so he's sort of complicit, if you like, in this sort of act of terror. And again, if we were to look at that fact in the context of the current debate about the referendum in relation to The Voice, Indigenous Australians who have had the brave, you know, the courage to say, in response to the invitation of Prime Minister Turnbull and the Leader of the Opposition, Bill Shorten, to come back with a proposal, you know, what's the way out of this morass that your people are in, with a statement from the heart, and even opening it up is subjecting to Indigenous leadership to bitter, hostile vitriol from non-Indigenous Australia. Shocking in its truth, you know, like in its reality. So,
but even part of Indigenous Australia is reacting, hostilely as well.
Yes. To their leadership, if you like. I mean, I think that's part of what's going on. If you take the fact that over 80% of Indigenous people support the statement from the heart, there's still a group that have rejected it, and in some cases, really quite violently, which makes you think. you know, how difficult is this reading then to understand that Abraham finds himself caught up in an act of violence against his own flesh and blood? Where do you go with that, Brendan? I'm struck by the fact that the text carries us along this path. And I think that, so one of my first experiences after parish ministry was working at the Williamstown Dockyard. And as a result of that, met with another Uniting Church member who was working with Australian Asia Worker Links, sort of building solidarity with workers here in Australia with Asia, and particularly Korea at the time, South Korea. And we formed a group called the Church and Trade Unions Committee. And the first person that rang me, one of the first people to ring me, was somebody who worked in the Uniting Church who'd just been sacked from the synod with no, you know, like actually literally clean your desk and marched out the door. So here we are walking with Abraham complicit in an act of violence which comes under the rubric of we're doing God's will here. So the fact that God actually calls a halt to this at some point, I think is pretty instructive, but I think it also points to the fact that the church is not immune or can't sort of claim a holier than thou sort of approach to violence. And the other thing that emerged from the Church and Trade Union Committee work was we started to look at the role of the church as an employer, and we talked to trade unions in the health and sector, and they said, the worst employers are church agencies.
Yes,
you know they expect people to do work for nothing.
Yes,
and we pay them next to nothing.
Yes,
and their working conditions run subject to all manner of violations of industrial standards. So this was quite sobering, and I think the reality of that is perhaps improved in some regard, but. I think that what we have to sort of, again, be honest about here is that the text is showing Abraham's complicity in an act of violence against his own son. And he does that because he believes he's doing God's will. And there's a point at which that trajectory is halted. But not before it's raised an enormous amount of anxiety on the part of the boy. Dad, what's going on?
And I was, in fact, quite struck by your statement a little earlier that part of Abraham's comeuppance, as it were, in this passage, is that he is complicit in an act of violence against his own flesh and blood. But, of course, Ishmael was his own flesh and blood, and he was quite happy. To be violent towards Hagar and Ishmael. And I wonder if this text then is reminding us of all the ways in which the structures of power and abuse within work, within church, within society, in fact, make us complicit in othering.
Yes.
And in the way in which we justify our violence by saying, well, they're not really me. You know, they work in a different department, or they belong to a different church or congregation, or they belong to a different racial or ethnic or cultural group. They're not actually my flesh and blood. They're other. And so I'm wondering if this passage is in fact read in light of all the violent and abusive power structures of modernity, is drawing our attention to how we become complicit in that violence.
I think the complicity is sobering, but it actually deepens the importance of not only the promise to Abraham that precedes all this, but in the heat of the battle, if you want, the heat of the moment, that disappears into the background a bit. But it actually comes to the fore when the point of act of Abraham actually doing the violent act, so all the preparation happens, but he's prevented from doing it by a divine intervention, at least that's the way the story reads. I think the other thing about this is the bit that's in between the two readings. So the NRSV calls it Abraham and Abimelech make a covenant.
Mm.
But the text in between the Hagar Ishmael story and this story are about Abraham as a guest in the land and making a covenant with, or a treaty about how he could live in the land.
Mm.
And it seems that, that sort of stands out as being a very important thing.
Mm.
But it's not so long later, after the Moses story, that there's no treaty here. You've talked to me about this previously, you know. Joshua essentially invades Canaan and does the whole colonial thing. So the Bible is telling a story about Israel and about its relationship to the nations. And while this story is sort of pivotal in bringing forward Jacob as one of the patriarchs, if you like, in setting up that part of the story that will lead to the time in Egypt, there's one reading of that happening that suggests that it's very hard. You can't just run a line through it and say this is the trajectory of what God's doing and what Israel's doing, because there is this sort of covenant story, this treaty story, which sort of, if you like, it's forgotten.
Yes.
But it's important for Israel after they get carted off into exile in Babylon. And essentially, you know, the whole Mosaic sort of commandments narrative runs into the sand under the monarchy. And then Israel, if you like, remembers this earlier story that we don't just know God through the Torah, the commandments and the land. We know God through this blessing, and we weren't even in the land. We actually were in the land as guests. Under a treaty. And this story that leads to Jacob being saved is sort of setting that story up for a re-evaluation, if you like, of how the relationship with God might be discerned, and it's complex. Not even quite sure where I want to go with that, but I think it's sort of perhaps just a reminder that when we put the story of the sacrifice of Isaac, I called him Jacob before, with the sacrifice of Isaac into the larger context, and also then read it through the formation of the canon, the formation of the whole narrative, it's got a number of different meanings, and I think when we try and look at it in relation to Christian ethics or social ethics, we can't read it outside of the whole political background of whose land we're in and whose God we're paying attention to.
It's interesting that, which you've just mentioned, that the fact that these two readings occur either side of an event in which Abraham enters into a covenant with a foreigner, a stranger, and yet you have these two powerfully abusive and violent episodes within his own family. And it reminds me of an observation that I've made more than once, that within our congregations we seem to find it easier to have good relationships with other denominations. But, you know, enter into any kind of relationship with the Uniting Church congregation down the road, forget it, you know, too hard. And so is there something, this is slightly depressing, I guess, but is there something about the nearness and closeness of our relationships that is fundamentally vulnerable to abuse, whereas those that are more arms distant, as it were, we can manage?
You just pulled a memory out of my time at East St Kilda. So at Union, there were three congregations of the Uniting Church in East St Kilda. The one at Windsor was a congregational church, was closed just after Union. And some of the money from that sale stayed with the other two in the parish. So East St Kilda on Hotham Street was a former congregational church. St George's was former Presbyterian. And they were in a parish together by the... It was done really by the carve-up into Union. It was a presbytery created this East St Kilda parish. And they had five members each on the church council. And four of the five from East St Kilda were related. And the congregation of East St Kilda had about 10 members. Half of them were related. And their basic position was that they wouldn't disclose anything at the church council that would show their vulnerability because they didn't want to be, they would lose their identity, which of course is what actually happened because they were, it was unsustainable.
Yeah.
And they were not really doing anything apart from one Sunday, 1 hour a week.
Yeah.
But the fear of their connection with the larger and perhaps even wealthier congregation was that they'd be taken over. And in the end, it wasn't so much they were taken over, but when it became clear that, that an amalgamation would need to happen, the family all left.
Yes.
So if they couldn't have their identity, then they weren't going to be in that new that new structure.
Yes.
And so the church has been amalgamating congregations from before Union. So one of the ironies is that at the point of Union, virtually the whole of Victoria rural churches were in joint parishes. Methodist Presbyterian or Methodist Presbyterian Congregational, some mix of the three. And the church had set up facility to enable this to happen 15, 20 years before Union. So Union came about in Australia because already rural parishes were finding that was the way they could sort of hang on to their identity.
Yes.
And when it came into suburbia, some of those same sort of things played out. So your observation, just it was a painful memory because it was sad, really, because to see people hanging on to that identity in the face of any sort of Christian commitment to being union, united, didn't cut any ice at all. It was about maintaining their sort of their property. So modernity, and particularly like capitalist ethics, valorizes competition.
Yes.
So, for example, with the banks, competition is regarded as being a good thing. But in fact, people, they go out of their way to create products that will differentiate them from one another wherever they can. And it's terrible.
Yes.
The products are often worthless, as the Royal Commission found.
Yes.
Particularly in relation to the Commonwealth's credit card thing. So we've got a text here where there's no competition before the one that we're reading. And actually quite a harmonious treaties established between Abraham and Abimelech. Whereas the Abraham-Isaac story is actually quite a violent story, really, full of threat and anxiety.
So if the mythological culture of modernity, if the ideology of modernity around the autonomous individual, around the identity of work as the mechanism to achieve the promises of this mythology, of how it makes us complicit in abusive relationships, both within work and within wider human life, if all of these are reflected in this reading, where does it reflect, or how does it reflect the way that God is perhaps calling us to something different? How, because we with the Hagar and Ishmael reading, the hope was essentially located in Hagar being able to separate herself or being separated from the identity in which she was previously embedded and seeing herself anew. Where or how or if does is this present in this text?
I think it's present in Abraham's eyes being opened. Hagar's eyes were opened and she saw a well.
Mm.
How could you not see a well? Mm. But there it was. Mm. She could see it and she got water.
Mm.
So here they are, they're up the mountain, Isaac's been put on the altar, strapped down, ready to cut the boy's throat or whatever. And Abraham looked up. Wow, he looked up and he saw a ram caught in a thicket of thorns. Mm. So
is it that attentiveness of Abraham to something other than himself that is ultimately the saving grace in this text? Because, you know, you mentioned that he, at the beginning, he is complicit in this act of violence against his son because he believes that God is commanding him to do it. But is that attentiveness that I think is signaled in Abraham's typical response, here I am, is that attentiveness to something other than his own prerogatives ultimately what saves him and saves Isaac?
It's a great Protestant question, I think. So I'd be more inclined to think that, well, no, there's a human agency and there's a divine, what shall we say, providential moment.
Mm.
So at the moment that Abraham's about to strike, he hears the angel of the Lord saying, no, you've done enough to show me your loyalty and your faithfulness. You've done enough.
Mm.
And he hears that and then he looks up.
Mm.
So I think that you're right. I think that there's a mindfulness or an attentiveness to hear.
Mm.
In the earlier story, it was the boy's crying was heard by God, and that brought God's intervention. But here, it's God seeing Abraham's, I'll go with fidelity, to what he thought he'd heard before, and God sort of speaks. But there's no point. I mean, I think we would say that God is speaking all the time, and it's a question of when we're listening, if you like.
Yes.
So that we ought not to underestimate the sort of importance of crisis in being times when our hearts might be opened to hear something more than we have been used to listening for.
Yes.
And that what we might hear is a new word or a word that speaks to a depth that we hadn't previously appreciated in life, because this is a transformative moment in the story.
Mm. So just as those people who've been through the painful process of being separated, sometimes quite violently, from their previously invested identity in work, there is, in modernity's construction of work and the suffering and harm that is experienced through that construction, there is a moment of crisis that also accords us the opportunity to see ourselves differently.
Yeah. And the Bible sort of runs a bit number of different ways. So some people might say that the crisis is product of God's providence. So God creates the crisis to create the opportunity.
Yeah.
But that's not how I would read this particular story. I would say that, well, no, you could actually, that God sort of pushed the button that got the whole thing rolling.
Mm.
But that I think for me, I would be emphasizing from a preaching point of view that God is in the midst of crisis.
Yes.
And that the crisis, whether it's crucifixion or this sort of crisis, is a product of bad faith or bad actions, of unjust things happening, that we as faithful Christians might look or be open to what's God, where's God present here? That would be the spiritual direction question. Where's God in this? And I think that here, bloody ram just got stuck in the brambles at the wrong time.
Yeah,
at the right place.
Yeah.
And yep, Abraham looked up. I think looked up.
Yes.
Sort of is quite in terms of the cosmology of a Hebrew worldview. Looking up would be the way to go.
And that is a decisive moment because it's almost a revolutionary action.
Yes.
You know, to look up, to no longer be bound by the status quo, by the current context.
Yes. Yes.
To in fact look up and see, as it were, the ram, the different.
Yes, yes. I think so. The NRSV says, so Abraham called that place, the Lord will provide. The alternative reading is that the Lord will be seen, or the Lord will see, something like that. And if it's like that, that the Lord will be seen, that speaks more directly to the way you're reading it.
Yes. All right. Well, I think at this point we can draw our discussion for today to a close. In our next episode, we'll look at readings for the 6th and 7th Sundays of the Pentecost season. But for now, John, thank you as always for your company.
Great to share this time with you, Brendan. Thank you.
And if you'd like to leave any comments, suggestions or feedback, please go to the podcast website at www.workingthelectionary.podbean.com. Working the Lectionary is available on Podbean, the hosting service for this podcast, but it is now available through Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. In the meantime, John and I look forward to your company for the next episode. Goodbye for now.
This has been Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary. Thank you.